This episode is brought to you by Interactive Brokers. And are you struggling to manage your finances across multiple banks and brokers and credit cards and even retirement plans? Well, Portfolio Analyst from Interactive Brokers simplifies everything and lets you consolidate, track, and analyze all your financial accounts in one place. Get a clear view of your portfolio's performance, your asset allocation, and risk with powerful analytics. Use the retirement planner to set personalized goals, plan for the future, and track your progress. And you can stay on top of your spending with the budgeting tool. Best of all, Portfolio Analyst is completely free and gives you powerful insights to help you take control of your financial future. Sign up for your free Portfolio Analyst account today at ibkr.com/freepa. Interactive Brokers is a member of SIPC.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
It only took a week. Tariffs on, tariffs off again. Huge rally seems to give institutions the ability to lighten up a little bit. And damaging policies have long-term impacts. Some thoughts on emotions and markets. And our guest today, Manuel Bly from thedowtheory.com. All this and much more on episode number 916 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello again. Another week of fun in the markets. Man, it started out awful. It got a little bit better. It got a little awful. It's then amazing. And then, oh, you know, I thought we would talk about this. I'm Andrew Horowitz, by the way. I am the founder of Horowitz & Company. I am also the host of this particular podcast, The Disciplined Investor, going back to 2007. We've been doing this. So it was a lot of fun with all the guests. I was looking back just last week at the list of guests we had, because somebody asked me, oh, you know, who have you had on? And I went back to see, and man, we have some amazing names over the years that have graced our show with their wisdom and their insights when it comes to markets and understanding how we can all deal with the things that happen, and particularly not when it's going swimmingly well, just that little bump and grind higher. But no, when we have things that are going on like we see right now, which is the abnormal, right? We don't see these kinds of things very often. Last week, we talked about it with our guest, and that was Tim Knight from the Slope of Hope, who is a self-proclaimed perma bear, and talking about how things are going and what he's doing. And I think in a little bit of a strange way, he was a little bit surprised of how badly things were going with regard to the markets. I'm sure he was happy with the way he was positioned. And hopefully we had some discussion on how you could learn a little bit on how to hedge and to make sure that your portfolio is not just sitting out there just getting lambasted. Yeah, we had an amazing day this week when President Trump did the dipsy doodle turnaround, which was kind of interesting. In fact, I've been talking about, you heard me talking about this, I've written about this, the idea that it seemed to be, as a matter of fact, we talked about this on Tuesday on DH Unplugged with myself and John C. Dvorak on DH Unplugged. And one of the topics was, you know, what's going to happen? And I said, hey, way out thought process here is that probably that we'll do a little deal with somebody, take Vietnam and say, hey, we got some victory there, take a victory lap, and then say maybe what we need to do is fire somebody who put on these harsh, crazy ideas of tariffs, and that would be Peter Navarro, possibly. Not Lutnick, but maybe. Peter Navarro's probably head's going to roll, in my opinion, at least from the aspect of how to save yourself from the disaster that happened if you're the administration, and then do like a 90-day reprieve, a look-see, a pause. We got the hint earlier in the week that that may be happening. When they saw that the 90-day pause, fake news, quote unquote, or leaked news, as I see it, came out, and then markets jumped dramatically, I think they said, interesting. Maybe that's something that we should think about doing. And now we have a 10% tariff across the board on every country in the world, the reciprocal tariffs, the crazy stuff that we saw on Tunisia, Kazakhstan, Serbia, Laos, the 74% reciprocal tariff on Botswana because of all the things that we take in from Botswana has been reduced back down to a flat 10%, which is better. Still not, you know, great because it's just this blanket thing. And China is now, and I think it's, where are we today? I don't know, 85, 95, 125 now, I think it is. And that's supposedly staying on. So now we pick the enemy. We want everybody else to bandy around us, or else the 90-day pause may come back right in your face. I think that's what the administration is planning on. They're saying, you know what, hey, if you get behind us and you help us with this China situation, let's all come together as a group and break them. And if we do so, we're on the same team. And if we're on the same team, well, we'll be much nicer and kinder to you. And with markets swinging wildly, a lot of you, a lot of me, people, everybody, all of us are kind of asking the same question. Is it time to panic? You know, we get this crazy move down for 1 week, starting on Wednesday, ending on Wednesday morning. 1 full week. And by the way, that's Wednesday afternoon, Thursday, Friday, Monday, Tuesday, half a day on Wednesday. We're talking about 5 days in total, right, of trading. Let's see, half a day Wednesday, let's see, Thursday, Friday, Monday, Tuesday, and half. Yes, let's call it five-ish days of trading. And panic. People are freaking out. And what do? This uncertainty that we have when it's looming over, it's important, I think, take a, I guess we would call it a measured approach. Because we need to recognize that the volatility in markets is a natural part of investing. And at the center of this, the latest turbulence, which is basically tariff-driven disruptions, we had a, before that, we had this carefully, this balanced global supply chain, and it's now facing new barriers, right, with higher costs. The long-term goal may just simply be to encourage domestic manufacturing, but in the short term, most companies like Apple and Nike, think about the car manufacturers, Ford, General Motors, they're all freaking out and grappling with higher expenses and potential profit declines, and even the possibility of weaker consumer demand. That's why some of these companies are starting to talk about laying off people. Now, adding to this tension and the problems that we're seeing right now is that the nations that were targeted by these new U.S. tariffs, which again has been softened, they were preparing retaliatory measures. They came in, now they're coming off, and that created uncertainty for American exports. So going back to the fact there was only 5 days of this that was going on, there was a lot of talk way before this. And the uncertainty, which is the key word here, the uncertainty that ensued on all this really freaked out companies, not knowing where they should go. Many companies went from China, they went to Korea, they went to Vietnam, they went to Laos, they went to Cambodia. We look at this list, I told you, Laos had a 95% import tax. Let's see where, I have this list right in front of me. Let's see where Vietnam was on this list. It's not there anymore. It's just a flat 10%. But Vietnam was at 90%. Thailand, 72%. Cambodia, 97%. Hello? That was painful for the Nikes, the Crocs, the Lululemons. I mean, you think about all the companies that actually thought they were doing the right thing by moving from China to Vietnam, as an example. And then they got face planted. So now one of the concerning factors that we all had with this is how all of this is being determined, right? Even though right now it's just a flat 10%, because instead of this careful targeting with specific industries, what we did was we applied a very simplified formula, basically dividing the trade deficit with a country by that country's exports to America. So let's take, for example, one country. You had Indonesia. So Indonesia and the U.S., they had a $17.9 billion trade deficit, our trade deficit with the country last year. While Indonesia exported $28 billion in goods and services to the U.S. markets. Based on the math, Washington imposed a steep 64% tariff, because if you read the fine print, the tariffs charged to the U.S. Was, let's see, including currency manipulation and trade barriers, whatever that means. Who knows? But when we look at this trade imbalance and this deficit and the numbers that we're looking at, you say 28, 17, divide it. Okay, what is it? Or 17, 28, 64. And that figure really raised some eyebrows about the long-term strategy and market impact. And that's why markets were saying, what? No, that's not going to work. And investors were really feeling the brunt of all this, right? Markets downturns created this emotional reaction. We were all freaking out, going, when is this going to end? Markets dropping 2%, 3%, 5% in a single day. And that instinct, what we feel, is often to sell quickly, reduce exposure. I don't want to have any more. Where is it going to go? It's going to go to zero. I don't want to lose all my money. However, and we learned this from Wednesday, maybe not so much what happened right after that, but exiting too soon can really result in missed opportunities, because there were some opportunities that popped up. When we first heard about Vietnam saying, you know what, we really don't want tariffs, let's drop it. We saw the likes of many of the companies that I mentioned earlier move up, those companies that do a lot of business in that area, in that country. And we missed the opportunities, particularly in a market that rebounds faster than expected. Those moves on Wednesday were unbelievable. Out of control, major, and significant. Beyond what anybody would expect. We saw that happen during the COVID crash. We saw that during the financial crisis. Many investors said, you know, I'm pulling out, I'm done, only to watch a surge unexpectedly, leaving them on the sidelines. Now, in some circumstances, it's okay to lighten up. And I encourage you to make sure that you are light enough that you're not going to have an emotional impact by it. You're not going to have a psychological or massive financial impact. Let me explain. If you're in a situation where you are invested in a way that losses will impede your living, that's not good. We had a client recently that decided that they wanted to totally pull out of the market, just get out. They're done. They don't want anything to do with this. I said to him, why are you doing that? Well, let me look at your portfolio. And the portfolio was an aggressive risk strategy. He says, I just can't do this anymore. I said, well, why are we sitting here in an aggressive risk strategy? And he said, I don't know. That's what I want. But you really don't want that, I said. He said to me, you know, you're right. So instead of doing that, let's kick it back a little bit and let's move into a more reasonable portfolio that sits you in the right position according to your risk, so you won't have these flare-ups of attacks, of emotional upheavals. Because we know something. We know that nobody can predict at all perfectly, but even partially perfectly, where markets will go next, right? There are steps, though, we could take as investors to manage our risk, hedge portfolios, right, against this uncertainty. And instead of making drastic changes and moves based on short-term fear, that word is going to come up again. Here it comes, diversification. Diversification is one of the strongest tools we can use to mitigate risk, because we maintain this mix of asset classes. I'll get back to my flower garden again. We look at sectors, we look at international, because a lot of that can help cushion portfolios against volatility in certain market conditions. Yes, there are those conditions like 2022 that nothing worked, throw it out the window, idea, theory, history, analytics, all of that. Statistics, ugh, no good. Generally speaking, though, when you have that flower garden, if you haven't heard this from me before, you want to make sure that you have something that's in bloom at any given time of the year. You don't want to have your flower garden entirely with impatience that look good up north during the summer, look great down here in Florida in the winter. The rest of the year, they're just ugly vines and dirt. You want to make sure that you have the azaleas, the perennials, the annuals, the evergreens. You want to have the roses, the heliconias. You want to have something blooming any given time of the year so that your portfolio and your garden look like they could weather storms. Now, yeah, there's going to be that occasional tornado once every 10, 20 years. But generally speaking, that flower garden, like your portfolio, should be able to weather a lot of different conditions. There's also things that you can do, like looking at option strategies, defensive sectors, alternative assets. These are all ways to protect your holdings while waiting for the conditions to stabilize. And markets have historically corrected themselves over time. We know that. There's every reason to believe they'll do so again and again and again. And while that uncertainty is surrounding what's going on in the markets now, right now about tariffs and global trade disruptions and all that, they have a real risk. But history has shown that long-term investors that are actually going in there and being both passive and active, being diversified, tend to come out ahead when they remained, important word, disciplined. So the key is not to have blind optimism or knee-jerk reactions, but I think you need to have this thoughtful adjustment and strategic hedging, and you want to make sure you have all this in place to ensure your financial stability, even during these kinds of turbulent times. I think that's pretty important. Now, another thing I want to talk about, there's a long conversation here because it's the beginning of the quarter. And as we are in the beginning of the quarter and we look at the earnings season that's about to come upon us, investors, I think, are really bracing for a critical moment that is going to provide some insights into what's going on with corporations, their performance, how uncertain are they? The inflation pressures, is that something? The trade policy. So analysts have already tempered their expectations. Let's just tell you right now, off the bat, that projections are showing weaker than expected growth across multiple sectors. That's just what's going on. So earnings growth for the S&P 500 companies is expected to come in somewhere around 6.1% year over year, which is a big drop from the 10.4% that was forecast in January. Now, revenue growth is projected to be 3.7%, which is also signaling a slowdown in consumer spending alongside rising input costs. And that a lot has to do with tariffs. The sectors, well, probably going to be mixed. Technology companies still leading earnings growth, expectations at 12.7%, though that's a decline from their strong showing in 2024. Financial institutions stand out probably as the only sector to see full-year EPS estimate increases during the first quarter, which is going to show some resilience among changing monetary policy. And consumer discretionary and industrials? Well, if you look at what's the numbers that are being presented, expected to struggle with some margin pressures, again, caused by some inflation, escalation in costs. Energy stocks, commodity-related industries, set to benefit from what we saw with surging crude oil prices and gold hitting record highs. A bit of a change with oil in the last couple of weeks. So we have earnings season kicking off. We saw this week JP Morgan, Citigroup, Wells Fargo, first to release the results. I don't look at those as an absolute. They usually come in looking pretty good with some commentary. Stocks move up, they move down. I like that to bake in over about a week or two after we see the totality of all the names that come in. And then we have the highly anticipated reports from the tech giants, right? The Mag 7 or the Lag 7. Expected to show 13.9% earnings growth, which really is way above the broader market. Retail and consumer goods companies such as Walmart, Target, also going to be providing some important updates. Walmart's going to pull its outlook. We saw that this week. So as the season unfolds, all of us are going to be watching closely how companies are going to be able to navigate the inflation challenge, the geopolitical risks, the consumer behavior that's changing. We saw that Amazon, Andy Jassy, said he doesn't see a change in any kind of consumer behavior as of yet. But ahead of all these reports, analysts already been slashing earnings estimates at clearly a faster than usual pace heading into Q1. The concerns that they mentioned again over and over, tariffs, supply chain disruptions, inflation pressures. So that's something to note, because one of the things we do want to see is if it is possible that companies can beat these lowered expectations right now. And according to FactSet, the bottoms-up earnings per share estimate for the S&P 500 dropped 4.2% between the start of the year and the end of the quarter, falling from $62 to $60 per share. That decline was larger than the 5, 10, and 15-year averages, and that shows that analysts are really bracing for weaker-than-expected corporate results. And it's all the same. You know, you look at the FactSet report, it's all about the tariffs, the reciprocal tariffs, the global supply chains, Chinese imports, steel, aluminum, auto parts, higher costs there. Supply chain disruptions is the big one that's also adding to uncertainty. And that, I don't think, can be understated about how that plays out. Businesses that depend on just-in-time inventory are struggling. Longer lead times, rising transportation costs, and manufacturers actually stockpile goods to avoid tariff-related price hikes. But that's led to warehousing shortages and logistical bottlenecks. So it's not great, right? Companies are trying to shift their production away from China, Vietnam, Mexico, and India. They now have, you know, they did this, and now they have all sorts of other hurdles. So a lot of variables at play right now. Time to buckle up, have a steady hand, and I think look for bargains with solid fundamentals. That's the play right now that I'm really going to look at. Now, before we get going on our guest, I'm excited about our guest because he has some, he sent me a whole bunch of items that we're going to talk about, some really interesting signals that don't happen very often. I want to talk to you about Interactive Brokers for a second again. I want to talk to you about why Interactive Brokers has key competitive advantages for sophisticated investors like you. IBKR's margin rates are from just 4.83% to 5.83%, and they're rated among the lowest margin fees by stockbrokers.com. Compare IBKR's low margin borrowing cost to other brokers like E-Trade, Fidelity, Vanguard, who charge hundreds of basis points more. Of course, rates are subject to change. Margin is only for experienced investors with high risk tolerance, because you may lose more than your initial investment. But note this, the best informed investors choose Interactive Brokers. Go right now to ibkr.com/compare. And our guest today, he's Manuel Bly. He's the editor of thedowtheory.com, a top-ranked investment letter that has been garnered a remarkable reputation for assisting investors in navigating bear markets while maximizing profits during the bull markets, which just sounds good to me. His investment letter is frequently quoted by Forbes and MarketWatch, Yahoo Finance, and others. And he's extended the application of the Dow theory beyond stocks to encompass U.S. bonds and precious metals. He has actively traded for his personal portfolio, and he's also, through his career, been a trader, investment writer, directorial position at an investment fund management company. So let's get right on with this discussion. I'm excited. So, Manuel, how are you? How you been? It's been a while.
Hey, thank you for having me on your show. Always a pleasure to be here.
I know.
Thank you, Andrew.
Listen, I thank you. One of the things that's interesting, especially from a market time, you know, look, a lot of people say you can't time the markets. And there is some truth to that from the aspect of using gut emotions, because a lot of people, when they think about markets, they like, I'm out because I can't stand it. Oh, let's get in because it's a good time. They don't use any real tested analysis and methodical indicators to get them there. Now, you're a lot different, of course, and you have a few things. And I want to go over some of the things that are going on in this market, which you and I talked offline, a little bit different than some market conditions, because some of the things that are going on are self-inflicted. Yeah. It is things that are newsworthy that happens and changes everything. Even a war would be more consistent than what we're seeing now. Wouldn't you agree with that?
More predictable.
Yeah, exactly. We're in the war. Bad things are happening. It's going to go on until it's over. Sometimes a little bit worse. Sometimes, but not, okay, We're in a war. We're out of a war. We're in a war. We're out of a war. We're, you know what I'm saying? We're going to add three countries. Yeah. Nah, you know what? We're not going to invade them. Right? That's kind of where it is now, right?
Yeah, the issue now is that it's totally unpredictable. So, well, you have a war, and from our wars, you know, that historically have been good for the U.S. stock market, until now at least. But now it's a hybrid tariff war, but we don't know. It's uncertainty every day. And this is, you know that uncertainty is what the markets hate. Markets don't like uncertainty.
You know, let's delve into that. Let's delve into that, because I've talked about that a lot. And I don't know if you even think I've gotten, I don't think I've ever defined what that means. I'll tell you mine and you tell me yours, okay? The problem with uncertainty and what markets hate uncertainty is because you don't know, you don't have the ability, and same thing with businesses, you don't have the ability to predict anything. In other words, if you have a set of inputs and they point to a certain result that you make up, whether you're right or wrong, it's a different story, right? But that's what you can go by. Now, all of a sudden, if you're walking along a lake that's frozen over, but you don't know, in fact, if it's frozen over enough to make that walk, you're just going to sit back and do nothing. And uncertainty with the markets is such that people just cannot quantify what the risk is. So you take it from there.
Exactly. You made a very good point that maybe when there is certainty, maybe you can be wrong in your analysis, but at least you have some kind of analysis. Maybe it is proven wrong, but at least you have a roadmap. But now the issue is that we have no roadmap. So tariff yes, tariff no, yes, retaliation. And of course, then you get frozen. You cannot, and this is what's happening from our, I'm afraid that it can also take a toll on credit markets. And well, it seems they are starting already to
suffer. Yeah, that's a problem that people aren't really talking about, right?
Yeah. And this is, I'm keeping an eye on high yield young ETFs and, well, our credit swaps and all these things, because I'm afraid that maybe something is going to break. I don't know what, but when you toy too much with a system, sometimes something can break inadvertently. So, well, let's see what happens. Complicated.
What's interesting is that I agree with you entirely. And, you know, that discussion of toying with the system, right? This idea that there is a significant amount of gaming going on without really a significant analysis. So when you're looking at what's going on and you have a variety of different market timing indicators, first of all, let's go through that. Tell people, let's go through, for those that haven't heard from you, exactly what the basis of your analysis is.
Okay. Well, we are market timers, but of course there are many breeds. So we are Dow theorists. So this means that we use the Dow theory in our own rendition, our own interpretation, which was developed by Jack Shanep, who for me is a genius. And the basic difference with the traditional Dow theory is that we also include the S&P 500. So we use three indexes. So Dow Industrials, the Dow Transportation, and the S&P 500, instead of just two indexes as the original or classic Dow theory does. The classic Dow theory only uses the Dow Industrials and Transportation, and Jack Shanep decided to include the S&P 500, which for me makes lots of sense, because you know that the Dow theory is almost 130 years old. So at that time, we didn't have the S&P 500. But of course, now we have it. So it makes, for me, it's a no-brainer that you should also include the S&P 500 as one of the indexes that belong to the Dow theory. So we are trend followers, but our trend following method is the Dow theory according to our own rendition, our interpretation. And with the Dow theory, we follow trends, but, and this is an important qualification, very occasionally, and I would say very opportunistically, we also bet for mean reversion. So we are trend followers, but sometimes we bet that there is a bottom, a tradable bottom, and then we are just the opposite. So then we take a trade when we feel that is the odds are very high for a mean reversion trade. We will talk later today, and this is what happened a couple of days ago. So first we became bearish, but now we are 50% bullish.
So if you're 50% bullish, does that mean you're like a small calf or a cow? What does that mean, 50% bullish?
Yeah, it means that, for instance, on March 4th this year, we got a Dow 30 sell signal. So this means sell, so go to cash. But last April 7th, we got a capitulation signal. Capitulation is one of our proprietary indicators, which means that the market is really extremely oversold. We get a capitulation signal more or less every 4 or 5 years. So this is a signal that triggers very, very seldom. So when we get a capitulation signal, we better pay attention to it because it's really very unusual to reach such a state of oversold markets. So all in all, last Monday, April 7th, we got a capitulation signal, which means that the odds are extremely high for a tradable rebound. We don't make predictions what is going to happen in the next 20 years. But of course, normally when our capitulation indicator triggers, it means that we are at the bottom or extremely near a tradable bottom. And then it means that according to our rules, then we go back to 50% invested. So we still don't get 100% position because we don't catch falling knives or at least not fully. Mm-hmm. And we want to get some kind of signal that the trend has once again turned bullish before we make 100% commitment. But nonetheless, when it becomes so extremely oversold as it became on Monday and also Tuesday, we had 2 days capitulation, then we say, okay, we test the waters, and then we start a 50% position. It was a nice trade because from March 4th, 2025, when we got the Dow 30 sell signal, until April 7th, I think the decline for the S&P was roughly minus 13%. So it was a great trade. So we got... We sold much higher, and then we partially rebought much lower.
Now you didn't short though.
Sorry?
You didn't short the market. You just went to cash.
Well, you know, I'm really very cautious with shorting the market. I will tell you, personally, for my own account, this time I didn't short. Maybe it was a mistake, and I will tell you why. Because this time the trend for margin debt it was still bullish. And I don't like to short when the trend of margin debt is bullish. Okay, I was wrong this time. I will make no pretense. But we play with probabilities. So here we don't play macho with the market and say, oh, I'm the smartest guy here. No, we are traders, so we play with probabilities. But of course, my studies show that when you get a Dow 30 sell signal, but margin debt, the trend of margin debt remains positive, then the odds for a very significant decline are smaller. It can go down. So I'm not going to lie. I'm going to tell you the truth. This time I didn't short, but of course I went to cash. Of course.
Yeah.
I don't argue against a sell signal. But in my own accounts, this time I didn't go short. If I had a negative trend for margin debt, then yes, then I would have bought an inverse ETF, and then I would be short, but not this time.
So when we see the sell signal, and it tells you, is there since you have a capitulation trigger, which then gives you a potential to put 50% in. Do you have a 50% out on a sell signal? Does that happen?
Well, when we trade the Dow 30 and we get a sell signal, we are 100% out, cash. We go to cash. until either we get capitulation, 50% backed invested, or we get the next DAO theory buy signal, which right now we don't have it. We need more a positive trend, which does not exist as of this moment. Mm-hmm. So, because, you know, we have several indicators, but today we are focusing on the DAO theory. So when we trade the DAO theory and we get a sell signal, then it means sell all. No excuses. We mm-hmm. sell all. So we went to the DAO theory, went to cash, 100% cash, on March 4th this year.
How often how often do those sell signals happen?
Good, excellent question. The DAO theory triggers roughly every 12, 13 months. For instance, our last buy was triggered on December 1st, 2023. So it was a very nice ride. Can you imagine? From December 1st, 2023 until, so this was the buy,
right,
until March 4th, 2025. So this was 15 months, something like that. The average tends to be 13 months for a run trade. So from buy to sell, it takes on average, let's say, 13 months. Well, everything has been tabulated, so it's not a guess. These are statistics. So it takes a little bit more than 1 year on average. Sometimes when the market gets very noisy or choppy, then you can get two, three run trades per year, but this is highly unusual. Normally we get every 13 months on average.
What if a capitulation trigger is very unusual, what are the usual triggers that get you back in?
Well, with the DAO theory, the trigger is when the trend turns positive again. So for instance, we get a sell. A sell signal means that, of course, that the trend was turning bearish, that a significant low was breached. And then, of course, then you have a bearish trend. So what will trigger the next buy signal? When we get again a bullish trend. How do we measure? Okay, we have the concept of secondary reaction. So it means we have, for instance, now we have the April 8th lows. Sorry. This was the last low. Then, for instance, now we need some days of a rally. What we have seen now is not enough. We need a little bit more time. And then we also require some extent. In our case, we have. So it means we need at least a 3% rally confirmed by two indexes. And then when you get enough time and enough extent, then you have a secondary reaction. Secondary bullish reaction.
So we didn't get the extent yet, but we did get the rally.
Yeah, but it's been only 3 days. So this is not enough time. Because, you know, one of the tenets of the DAO theory is, and this is what makes the DAO theory so accurate, because not any rally will qualify as a valid rally to trigger a buy signal. And this helps the DAO theory to really to reduce lots of whipsaws. So, for instance, in this specific case, I think we had the lows on April 8th.
Okay.
And then, we had a couple of good days.
That was just a few days ago. Yeah, okay, gotcha.
Exactly. But the DAO theory requires, there are two main tenets, principles. First is that we require a minimum time and a minimum extent. What do I mean by that? Time means that, for instance, a three-day rally or a four-day rally is not enough time. We want to see more upward action. And secondly, it's not only the time, we also require some extent. So I mean, for instance, the rally should be at least 3% on the S&P and one other index. Well, this time the extent requirement, of course, has been fulfilled, this is clear, but the time requirement hasn't been met. And then there's another qualification for a rally, for a bounce, to be really valid, which is the principle of confirmation. What do I mean by that? So let's imagine that, then we get the S&P 500, it rallies for, I don't know, 10 days, the time requirement and extent requirement are met, so everything is fine, but the Dow Industrials and the Dow Transportation refused to confirm because they only rallied for, they only bounced for 3 days, for instance. So the Dow theory requires that at least one index confirms the S&P. So the S&P has to bounce for, let's say, 10 days, 5 days, whatever is a, the time requirement and the extent requirement. But at the same time, such a movement must be confirmed by either the Dow Industrials or the Dow Transportation. So when you put together all these qualifications, so you need minimum time requirement, minimum extent requirement, plus confirmation, then you really get very valid signals. So you really get rid of lots of noise, because the movement of one index and confirmed by the other index, it usually is very deceptive. So normally it tends to trigger false signals. Mm-hmm. And this is, well, this has been more than tested, tried under fire, and it really works. The principle of confirmation works. And furthermore, even outside of the realm of the Dow theory, you can take a moving average. I don't believe in moving average. That doesn't work, for, at least for me. But even if you take a humble 200-day moving average, whatever, to time the market, and this is very easy to program, to code in the computer, and you say, look, I'm going to buy when, I don't know, when the price is above the 200-day moving average, and I'm going to sell when the price is below. Very simple rules. You do the test, and of course, it's nothing stellar, nothing great, because the moving average are not great. But in the very moment, you say, okay, but I'm going to look for confirmation. So let's say I'm going to trade this S&P, but at the same time, I want that the Dow Industrials confirms by being also above or below the its respective 200-day moving average. Surprise, surprise. Then you will see that the results improve significantly. Not to the extent of the Dow theory, because the Dow theory is for, in my opinion, is the best trading system. But we will see that even if you use a very modest moving average, in the very moment you include, you demand confirmation from other index, you will have less whipsaws, and you will get more accuracy in your signals. So the principle of confirmation works. This is, for me, it was already known in the 1930s, and it continues to work, and I'm sure it will continue to work, because it makes sense. You are using similar assets, one index, like the S&P, another correlated index, like the Dow Industrials, for instance. So you're using correlated indexes, not the same, but correlated, because this is like Goldilocks. You need some correlation, but not correlation of one. So they should be similar, but not exactly the same. This is how the principle of confirmation works. But it really works. And
Where's the stopgap? What happens if you get the capitulation trigger, you get, what I'm saying, what if, okay? What if you get the capitulation trigger, you go 50% in, then you get the time, you get the extension, you go 100% in, and then things go sideways.
Okay, then it's very clear. In the what you said is that we get a buy signal. We get the secondary reaction, all the requirements, confirmation, time, extend, everything is fulfilled. Uh-huh. We get the buy signal, okay? Then we go to 100% invested. And then once we are 100% invested, the capitulation lows are our new stop loss. So let's imagine that April 8th was the final lows, and the current bounce lasts a couple of days more. We get the secondary reaction, the buy signal. And then let's imagine that the market takes a nose dive. It plunges. It goes down. Mm-hmm. And then when all three indexes, the Dow Industrials, Transportation, and the S&P, break down below the April 8th lows, then, unluckily, regretfully, we get a sell signal, and then we would sell everything. Because when the trend speaks, we don't argue. So if the trend becomes bearish, we don't argue. But we require triple confirmation. So, because normally a capitulation signal, we have these statistics, is really extremely powerful in calling bottoms. So when you have had capitulation, the odds are extremely high for significant higher prices ahead. So this means that I'm going to sell if those lows are broken down, but then I will require triple confirmation. So I want the S&P, the Dow Industrials, and transportation, all of them, to breach their respective, in this case, that would be April 8th lows.
So, but I guess what that means is that you technically can't lose money on that.
Well, sometimes you can lose money because this is a trade, and this is why, well, we are traders, so we deal with probabilities, not with certainties. But for instance, when you get capitulation, it's extremely unusual. For me, what do I mean by extremely unusual? I would say that 90% of the trades don't test the capitulation lows. Mm-hmm. It means once you get capitulation, 90% of the time, the market will go up, 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 and up.
Right.
And eventually you will sell, but you will sell not at the capitulation lows. You will sell because you get maybe a 6 months or 12 months rally, and then you get the next authorized sell signal. But the next authorized sell signal, it's maybe 15%, 20% above the capitulation lows. I want to be very straightforward. Of course, sometimes we got a sell signal and it was a failed capitulation, but it really happens very seldom. Furthermore, on the public area, so on the free area, public area of our website, there are statistics of capitulation. And one can see that most of the time, I would say 90% of the time, once you get capitulation and afterwards you get the Dow 30 buy signal, those lows are never revisited. So the market goes up, up, and up.
That's at the Dow Theory. By the way, it's at thedowtheory.com. That, yeah. Right? That's the place where they can find that on the public side of it?
Yes, don't forget the article, thedowtheory.com.
Yep.
Exactly.
And thedowtheory.com.
There is a tap indicator, and there is on the free area capitulation.
So what's next? We look at you know, a lot of things that are going on right now. You must have concerns that, again, this is self-made and self-inflicted, and this is something that doesn't deal with earnings or interest rates, et cetera. But in the background, some of the macro, the geopolitical, and now we're starting to see something happening, something breaking loose, ever so slightly, maybe the beginning phases of the bond market. You want to talk about that?
Yes, well, of course. There are two things. The technical aspect.
I can't hear you very well. Can you talk up? Can you speak up?
Sorry.
Yep.
There are a couple of things. One is the technical aspect concerning capitulation, the numbers. And the other thing is what I think now, putting those numbers in context. So let's first focus on the technical aspect. When you get capitulation, it's good to know that the average bounce rally 6 months after capitulation is a hefty 16.9%, which is much more than the average S&P return in any 6 month period. So in other words, this is what I was telling you, that capitulation really favors very strong price appreciation ahead. So 6 months after capitulation, the average rally is 16.9%. And 1 year later, fasten your seatbelts, please, the average return following capitulation is 29.2%, which, of course, you know, it's much more than the average annual return for the S&P. So this is the technical side. So this is why I was telling you that really capitulation is very powerful. So you get much higher than average returns 6, 1 year, and also 2 and 3 years ahead. I think 3 years ahead is a very solid 46% return. So it means that really capitulation turbocharges the stock market. But it was the technical side. So if we are just playing by probabilities or the statistical record, this is an extraordinary tailwind for the stock market. But of course, we live in times of uncertainty. So the question is, will this capitulation signal be as reliable this time? So there comes my concerns this time. Well, the first one is uncertainty, of course, what we have been discussing before, because it is better to have your economic forecast and being proven and being wrong than having...
Right, now, that's what we said. It's easier, not easier. It's just a good thing at least to have some solid ground to walk on before you take a jog.
Exactly. No, I fully agree. So right now, well, you know, sometimes maybe this is going to be a good thing, because I don't know, if finally the USA manages to reach free trade agreements with the European Union, with other countries, and maybe if the unexpected happens, which would mean that we get even more free trade, because maybe this is a bluff. We really don't know. There is uncertainty. But what if now the USA engages in negotiations and eventually we get, for instance, the European Union that says, look, we are going to see more Chevrolet, more Fords, more Cadillacs, more American cars in Europe. Because I'm going to tell you one thing here, and this is the fundamental part. Look, I am from Spain. Well, you notice my accent.
Mm-hmm.
I'm from Europe. You've been on vacation. You were recently, some months ago, on vacations in Europe. How many Cadillacs did you see? How many Dodge? How many Chevrolets? How many Fords? Well, there is Ford Fiesta, a small one that is manufactured in Spain.
If they have more Ford, many, no, the other one, you don't see none.
And did you? I'm sure you saw no single American car.
No, no,
why?
Nope. Because they're too big and they don't fit down the small cobblestone streets.
Yeah, and also, you know, because of regulations, because they are not environmentally friendly according to European standards. So there are... It's not only the monetary tariff that matters. It's also the environmental regulations. There are lots of unseen trade barriers. And of course, this is why you will see Citroën, Renault, Fiat, all the European brands in Europe, but you won't see any American brand in Europe. And of course, things I don't know whether this is a bluff or uncertainty. I don't know how it's going to happen, but could you imagine a scenario where suddenly Europe, for instance, says, okay, I'm going to make easier for Europeans to drive a Ford, a Chrysler, whatever.
Yeah.
And eventually we get more free trade because the European Union and other countries, they lower their tariffs and also the invisible tariffs to American, to US products. Then we could end up having a Goldilocks scenario where we get even more trade than before.
And which would be very, very nice. You know, I think no objection to any of this. My objection has always been, can we please do it with a surgical precision rather than a sledgehammer?
Oh, no, true. No, I agree with you.
And use a little bit more diplomacy and a little less of bluffing. And the fact is that already now the problem is the 90-day, this 90-day pause thing, which keeps on getting cropped up when things don't go well. The market's going to test him. The market's going to test him, and he's going to blink. And if he doesn't, he's going to crush everything. Now, when I say he, I'm talking about the administration, whether it's Navarro, whether it's the president, whether it's whatever the administration at large.
Yeah,
you know, they've got to come together with a well thought out, not off the hip, not ill. At the beginning of the show, I talked about how this calculation was done to come up what the reciprocal or what the tariffs will be, including currency manipulation and trade barriers. That was this whole calculation of the differential in deficit versus surplus, and just take that, divide it, and that's what we're charging. Like, who, what fifth grader thought of that?
I agree. I agree with you. And this is why the market tank it.
Yeah.
And I think, well, the market gave also sent a strong message to the powers that be that we have to be careful. You know, in the beginning of the interview, I said that one of my worries is credit markets and also what happens with young bonds.
Yeah.
So I fear that if we game or toy too much the system, something might break, but in the credit chain. And then, of course, then we are playing with fire, and we are playing with fire. This is my fear that, so I agree with your word. I like the sledgehammer. So let's do it with a little bit more.
a little bit more finesse. But the point here is, I think the culmination of our discussion here is that, you know, there's a lot of different ways to look at things where if you're a hedge fund manager that deals with news-driven activity or even fundamentals, and you look at what's going on, you can make some decisions based on that. And then you have some technical analysis, just looks at charts, maybe supply areas like support and resistance, overhead resistance, and maybe even utilizing a variety of indicators. Then there's a combination of utilizing different core statistical measures, which you do, with regard to the pricing action and other things to come up with where it is. But in the end, you have your methodology that has been tested over time, that you believe in, by the way, because I can hear it in your voice. You believe in it.
I deeply believe.
You do believe. Yeah. And it's not like, oh, we got a capitulation trigger, which, by the way, when you get those, I'm assuming you got to hold your nose sometimes and just go.
Yeah. you know what's funny? That those days I was getting lots of emails from subscribers trying to lend me a hand, saying, look, have you looked at this indicator or whatever? Extraneous indicator. So they can be very good. But of course, I have my micro world with my time indicators. I know them inside out. I know that they have a track record. For more, it's not a back test.
Right.
Because, you know, Jack Shanev has been trading them. I have been trading them. So it has a really long track record of real trading, not mm-hmm. just a back test.
Right.
They were back tested, but then real. This is a huge out of sample real life trading. So, you know, I feel this is maybe my comfort zone, but this is my area of expertise. I know all the indicators inside out, and I also know the interplay between them, how capitulation complements the Dow theory. So I know it works. So I also know that in a particular trade, it can be a loser. Of course, more or less 70% of our trades are winners and 30% of our trades are losers.
Get louder. You're fading.
So I make no pretense of being infallible. Say, look, Mr. Bralai makes... No. 70% right, 30% wrong. But the good news is that the win-to-lose ratio is 5-1.
Well, that's the point right there, right?
That's the point. So we are traders. And sometimes it's difficult for people to understand the trader mindset.
Yeah.
So I win 70% of the time. And when I win, I make 5 times more than when I lose. So this is an excellent win-to-lose ratio. So then, of course, do I take a hit sometimes? Yeah, I get losing trades. But, okay, but it's part and parcel of the games. Okay, this is what happens with trading. So nobody can be 100% right. This is, for me, I'm not able, but I can live with my system. And this is what was happening, that I was getting emails from subscribers because, of course, there is lots of nervousness. So when the market is like now, you get really lots of emails, anxious, nervous. And they will say, have you looked at this indicator or this other website?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not to demean the other indicators. They can be good, but you have to deeply believe in your own indicators. You have to have faith in them. Yeah. And of course, this is my comfort zone, or call it whatever you want. But I know my indicators. I know how they work, how they work under very different market conditions. And I know that if I start to second guess my time indicators, then I'm going to be wrong more often than not. I'm sure.
Yeah.
So finally, the best thing I can do is really to honor my indicators. But that said, there are a couple of fundamental things I don't like this time, and they have nothing to do with uncertainty. You know, the yield curve was inverted since October 2022, the 3 months, 10 years, and then, well, despite all odds, we got a bull market, because normally, you know, that an inverted yield curve, normally...
And no recession.
And no recession, both, exactly.
Right, yeah.
You know better than I. So an inverted yield curve is really a bull market killer, And also a recession is
Exactly. 6 months of recession countdown.
And this time we got no recession. For a month we got a bull market. And of course I was, well, since my indicators were bullish in our letter to subscribers, I said, look, this is what I see with inverted yield curve, but my indicators are bullish. So I gave the benefit of the doubt to my indicators. So we went 100% invested. But, and now comes a big objection now. Okay, exceptionally, that time in October 2022, the yield curve, well, was proven wrong. So no indicator is perfect all the time. But the yield curve uninverted by the middle of December of 2024.
Mm-hmm.
You know that when the yield curve uninverts, it means that trouble is really very near. You could also ignore maybe this signal, say, well, maybe it's also wrong, like the first inversion. Okay. But then, like the movie, the doorman, the postman always rings twice. You know, the Mike Nicholson and Jessica Lange, great movie. So now we got, by the end of February, a second inversion. So we got, look at the sequence. October 2022, start of the bull market, yield curve inversion. I disregard, I said, well, I think this time is wrong. So we go 100% invested. I was right. But this doesn't mean that the inverted yield curve is dead forever, okay? That time was wrong, but two things happened afterwards. First off, the bull market was older because we had already 2 years of a bull market since October 2022. So first thing. And second thing is that the yield curve uninverted in December. I insist, yield curve and inversions tend to signal but really big problems for the stock market, recessions, etc. But if this were not enough, then in February, the yield curve once again inverted. And there comes the movie. The postman always rings twice. So maybe the first time it was not the real thing and we got a bull market. But now the situation is different. Now we have a more than middle-aged bull market. And maybe the second time the postman rings, this time is going to be now is the real thing. So, and this is even irrespective of Trump's tariffs and all this uncertainty, the thing I really don't like now. So a second inversion preceded by a yield curve and inversion. So this is too much of bad news. And well, you know, I don't like that. So normally this means a bear market and a recession. But what happens when we have had capitulation? Who will win? I don't know. But if we look in years 2008 and 2009, we had also capitulation, and it was coupled with an inverted yield curve, and then not all of them, but there were a couple of capitulation, but one of them was not such a good signal. So this is why in this specific case, although capitulation statistically means a strong tailwind for the stock market, I'm leery because of the inverted yield curve. So will it be 2008 again? I don't think so. I'm looking a lot at the financials because, of course, if something horrible happened, then XLF, the ETF or the financial sector ETF, should be heading south.
Yeah.
And for the time being, is weathering the storm. For the time being, is holding up well. But I'm really keeping an eye on high yield bonds. Well, anything that can signal credit stress.
Problems in the credit area.
Exactly. Problems in the credit area. Because, you know, Andrew, the difference. Even if we get some kind of, I don't know, even a softer landing, not a soft landing, but a softer landing, mild recession, whatever, if the financial sector holds up well, then such recessions are short-lived and not so horrible, which means that the stock market, okay, can go down, but not that much. The really bad recessions with really deep bear markets is when you get the recession coupled with problems in the financial sector.
Right.
Then Houston. Exactly. Then Houston,
yeah.
We have a problem.
I hear you.
And this is why I'm really keeping an eye, because of course, so now we have two opposing forces. The technical is capitulation with an excellent track record that says, look, this is a huge tailwind for the stock market. But on the other hand, we have the inverted yield curve, which normally is a headwind for the stock market. So two opposing forces, the technical and the fundamental.
Right.
So, so what's for me the tiebreaker is look at the financial sector, provided credit swaps, all these things, young bonds, the financial sector is holding up well. I am quite optimistic, and I give the benefit of the doubt to the technical capitulation indicator.
Good stuff. Manuel Bly from the DowTheory.com. Always a pleasure having you. Thank you so much for joining us. Well, let's see what's going
to
happen. It's going to be kind of fascinating as we go through the next couple months with all this gyrations and sledgehammers and thin ice. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you, Andrew. Thank you.
All right, I'll speak to you. Thanks. Well, that's going to do it for this episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. We're going to see how it goes. Obviously, we're seeing a lot of jagged movement and ups and downs that are quite gut-wrenching. But if you stick to your plan and you have a plan, and then you can stick to it, so you got a big plan first, you know what? Things will be okay. We'll get out of this eventually. You know, the world is not going to end at this point. Maybe some other day, but not now. And the reality is that still, in the end, the equity markets, the capital markets of the world are the best ways create wealth. Thanks for joining me this week and every week on The Disciplined Investor. I'll see you again real soon. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.